Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast with a carbon footprint double the global average. My name's Corey Hazelhurst, and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hi, Corey.
And we are joined for the third time in the series, regular guest, Councillor John Cotton. Hello, John.
Hiya.
This is the penultimate episode of our third series, which has all been about personal responsibility. And this week, we're talking about our responsibility for climate change. What responsibility do we have for causing climate change? What is our carbon footprint? And what should we do about it? And I'd like to start, if I can, by talking about Bangladesh, which I think is quite a good example that sets up a good starting point for a discussion on responsibility and climate change. If predictions from those experts, and we've seen how wrong they can be, but if those predictions are right, then by the end of the century, sea levels will rise by about a metre. And Bangladesh is a country that if sea levels do rise by a metre, then a third of its coastline will basically disappear. If that happens as well, then you'll have more salt water, which goes inland, and that will destroy crops, it'll destroy villages and so on. There's estimates, again from those so-called experts who've been proved wrong before, that the cost of Bangladesh adapting to climate change by building cyclone shelters, building flood defences and so on, is about $4 billion, give or take a nickel. And Bangladesh's annual budget is $10 billion. So obviously, Bangladesh paying for it itself is out of the question. But I think the Bangladesh example shows the problem in that most carbon dioxide is emitted from rich countries, and there's some estimates that actually it's the richest 500 million people on Earth tend to be from the rich global north that emit most carbon emissions. But the effects of climate change are mostly visited on those in the poorest countries in the world who don't have the infrastructure to cope with it. Places like the Maldives, for instance, the Maldives could disappear entirely as a result of climate change. And Bangladesh's emissions are only a 20th of the global average. Maybe the first place to start is, how can we try and connect the abstract concept of our responsibility to climate change with solving the practical problem for places like Bangladesh and the Maldives? No pressure.
Can we have an easier start of a 10?
How does Labour win the next election?
It all boils down to actually finding a way to demonstrate this is how it will affect your average person in those richer countries. At the end of the day, it's whenever we talk about famines, floods, whatever in other parts of the world, what normally happens is people go, "Oh, that's really terrible. I'll donate some money," and then it's just forgotten about because it's over there. It's not something that you have to deal with in your day-to-day life unless it's constantly in the news for some reason. This doesn't just apply to climate change, this applies to pretty much any kind of foreign political news as well. For absolutely ages, Boko Haram had captured some school children, and there was hashtags of bring back our girls, there was news media coverage of it all over the world. Those children have, for the most part, not been returned, and yet you don't hear a thing about it anymore because the story's moved on. With climate change especially, getting people to kind of focus on it as part of their everyday lives does involve bringing it back to them and how it's going to influence them. These are just off the top of my head examples. But if there's a situation where, say, climate change is going to increase certain crop, the price of certain crops which are grown in certain areas, then, you know, finding a way to get that message through would be a good start. Focusing more less on, you know, Bangladesh is going to end up in a horrific position, and more on these random idyllic countryside villages in the UK are going to end up flooded and not livable in. It's probably going to resonate a lot more with people because it's something that they can imagine a bit more, because there's always, every summer, pretty much a new story of, and now somewhere in Kendal has been flooded due to a lot of rain or something like that. And everybody's been to those sorts of villages. There are a load of people have family in those sorts of villages or those sorts of small towns. Because of that, it becomes a lot easier to make the case for this is linked to this, therefore we need to do something about it because it's affecting you and your friends and family.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's almost a how do you connect it to your own self-interest in some ways, kind of enlightened self-interest. It is very easy when you see it's happening somewhere far away to go, oh, well, I'll make a donation or something, and then it's not my problem anymore, I'll carry on with my life. And it is, how do you connect it to the lived experience?
So is it maybe about how the environmental movement markets itself? I think in the political brain, Drew Weston says that you can make a very almost socially conservative case for the fact you're protecting the environment, you're protecting God's creation, or you're protecting God's children. And so if you maybe make the case that it's protecting nature as a good in and of itself, is that one way of doing it?
Yeah, that potentially would be one way of doing it. The other thing would be obviously kind of attaching it to concepts which people are already bought into as a notion. So given the current kind of the political context that we find ourselves in the UK, buy British is a thing which has kind of come up a number of times from like Brexiters and things like that. You know, there are lots of benefits to buying British things in terms of the economy and things like that, but one of the other added benefits is if you're buying British, it's not being flown in. If you're buying Welsh lamb rather than New Zealand lamb, it's not being flown in across half of the world. Carbon emissions are lower. If you're buying British, chances are the vegetables and fruit are going to be seasonal. It's better for the environment in that regards as well. Buying British is a very patriotic thing. The sorts of people, for the most part, who are very or more likely to be skeptical of climate change and the actions to help resolve it tend to be the sort of people who respond well to patriotism. So you can kind of link things up like that as well, I'd say.
So maybe, I mean, something that's in the news the week that we're recording this, again, bringing climate change back home, as it were, is air pollution. So this week, The Guardian and Greenpeace released a report about how there were various schools and nurseries which were near sites where the amount of nitrous oxide was above the legal limit, including actually the school I taught at last year. John, your scrutiny committee has been, it is your scrutiny committee, you are the scrutiny committee.
Well, I chair it, there's a few others who do a bit,
meet in the room. But you've been looking into the impact of this in Birmingham.
Yeah, and actually there's some really striking statistics around the impact that air pollution has on health. So there's something like 900 deaths a year in Birmingham that can be attributed to air pollution. If you think, 30 deaths a year attributable to road accidents. So
what? So it's 30 times as much?
Yeah, so it's really striking. So I think it's something like 5% of all mortality can be in Birmingham on a yearly basis can be attributed to air pollution. So all of that stuff in terms of nitrogen dioxide, you know, particulates, everything else that's been pumped into the atmosphere has a very clear effect in terms of mortality. And then there's all the other stuff that happens around, you know, people turn up with respiratory conditions, the impact on the health service and so forth. So it's one of those things that really needs to get a lot more exposure than it does at the moment. I think actually it's coming back to the how do you make it relevant to people's lived experience locally? Things like that bring it very starkly home.
Yeah, and I think also this is provides potentially quite a good example of one of the difficulties that you can have. Obviously, with a city like Birmingham, there's a million odd people who live within the city confines itself. Mm. But an awful lot of that air pollution that was coming in is also coming in from outside, in effect, by commuters who are driving in for work or driving in for the weekend or to go see a Villa match or whatever it is. And those people aren't necessarily going to be bought into the notion of keeping Birmingham's air clean, because they're not in Birmingham, they're not Brummies themselves. You know, they're not going to see it in the day-to-day in the same way that we might, because we live in the city. And again, it shows that even at kind of the local level, those kind of wider, it's over there issues can still potentially have an impact, and finding ways to kind of link up what's happening in Coventry and the people who are kind of driving into Birmingham to work, the impact that they're having and how that has a negative impact on them is something that you probably need to look at as a part of a solution to that.
I suppose that's the Bangladesh problem in the microcosm, isn't it? That if someone in Coventry can't really relate to some air pollution deaths in Birmingham. And maybe it's also then about, again, the last time we were in the bunker recording this, we were talking about obesity and the changing culture that maybe needed to happen there for a solution. And I suppose climate change is an even bigger example of that, where the things that happen that impact on climate, like going on holiday or travelling to see Aston Villa, which, I mean, let's face it, it's a colossal act of self-harm, even if it's not an environmental issue, or even things like buying meat from someone that isn't locally sourced or buying meat from a takeaway, they're things which we don't see in themselves as being morally wrong, yet they are contributing to these massive global problems and massive local problems as well. The reason why it's hard to put across the notion of responsibility for climate change is because the things that cause it, we don't see as being morally wrong yet. So say, for instance, if tonight we said, right, we're going to have a takeaway, and we're going to have a Chinese, and we'll have some sweet sour pork or something. If you were to turn around and say, well, actually, I don't think that pork is going to be locally sourced, and it's probably come from far away, I don't think we should do that.
We'd laugh at you and call you a pretentious
swear word,
insert swear word here. In that regard, yeah, I suppose it hasn't quite... Well, no, it basically hasn't become acceptable thing to be snotty about or to raise a fuss about in the same way. And generally speaking, if you do raise that sort of stuff, you do get labelled as basically a hipster tosser. I don't know if moral's quite the right term for it, though. But there is certainly a kind of a social norm around what is and isn't acceptable, so surrounding kind of food and things like that, which is not beneficial to helping solve climate change. I think for me, this is one of those situations where an awful lot of focus when we talk about climate change has always been on kind of like, it's one of the reverse of like obesity and a load of other things, where the focus has always been on the individual rather than the collective. 90% of the kind of discussion you hear about climate change, it's all about the Kyoto protocols, it's all about the Paris Climate Agreement, it's about governments getting together to do things, it's about government funding for renewables and building more wind farms and all of that sort of stuff, rather than individuals actually taking a bit more responsibility for themselves and saying, I can do this to help reduce my carbon footprint. I mean, one of the things that we all did before we recorded this podcast was we all took was it the WWF?
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, with the World Wildlife Funds, not the World Wrestling Federation's, carbon...
That's a very different carbon footprint.
Carbon footprint calculator. And it was quite interesting to see, because there were a number of things when I took it that I went, oh yeah, I'm not doing that particularly well in terms of my individual activity and things like that, which showed by the fact that I was using 115% of the resources that compared to what it should have been. It should be at about 100%. Or even lower, ideally, and I was over that. So, and that's
killing Bangladeshis as we speak, just by your existence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
As opposed to killing fat children last week.
Yeah, I am. Terrible.
We do need to put some sort of zone around him, really, don't we? Clearly, a threat to many. The calculator was interesting though, because I came in at 102. And a lot of the food and lifestyle things, I wasn't in a bad place, but it was actually transport. And I'm saying this in the perspective of somebody who doesn't own a car, never had a driving licence, uses public transport to get around, does a lot of walking. So you're kind of looking at that, scratching your head a little and going, well, what more can I do to squeeze down the carbon footprint if transport's the major issue?
And that's where, from an individual perspective, there's probably not much more you can do other than, walk everywhere for the rest of your life. Which will help, therefore, solve the obesity
problem. It solved my own personal obesity problem.
But that's where, the collective kind of actions do come into it. I mean, one of the things that we're starting to see in Birmingham, for instance, is a lot more, at least partially electric, hybrid buses. Actions so that councils, for instance, working with the various bus operators in their areas to bring about that would be good. The government actively prioritising transport links like that would be good as well.
I think it's absolutely essential. Again, it plays back to what we're unearthing with the air pollution stuff. So as one of my colleagues puts it, the devil's very much in the diesel. diesel-operated public transport, diesel-operated trains. We've got to try and find a way of shifting that over onto the more, electrical, more sustainable form of transport, which will have, obviously, great impact on people's health and the troubles that are caused by pollution.
With my carbon footprint, as I say, it was 102%, which is the same as you and slightly above what it should be to try and help climate change. And like yourself, my biggest expenditure in terms of the carbon footprint was travel. And that's despite the fact I don't even get the bus to work anymore. I walk to work every day. But because I took 2 flights on holiday to Europe last year, that's a massive amount of carbon dioxide that I just kind of flunked up in the atmosphere. Buying things wasn't a thing, and consumerism wasn't either. I don't buy many clothes, as you can tell, and most I basically.
I think you might need to clarify that. This is not a visual podcast.
Dear listeners, well, it's not sat around this kitchen table naked. Patch a photo to the website.
With today's paper proving. But most of my spendings are on secondhand books, and I think actually another big. My other two big expenditures were food, I think, probably because of the amount of meals I have out, or probably meat. And meat eating is quite a big thing. And again, in the home, because I'm renting a house, I'm not able to do things like install carbon saving things in the roof and insulation,
yeah.
All those kind of, and new boilers, eco-friendly stuff, and all the things you could do if you owned the house, or if you were a really eco-friendly landlord that you'd do, but you just don't do if you're renting.
Like both of you guys, transport was quite a huge chunk of my carbon footprint as well, according to that calculator. And like you guys, I don't drive. I get the bus to work every day. I walk an awful lot of places. If I'm going to the shops or something like that, I'll normally walk up rather than get any form of transport. And yet that, through probably living like an awful lot of other people as well, puts me on 115 out of what should be 100. And I don't drive. Anybody who drives is going to be in the 120 to 130, if not higher, depending on what it is. I mean, the other thing is that the question that was asked on the calculator was about personal kind of flights that you took. It said non-business. If you were to factor in business flights for me, I mean, I went to Greece a couple of times for work last year. That's four flights right there I had to take to you know, the south end of Europe, which is an awful lot of carbon dioxide, which will be going out into the atmosphere. In regards to that, there's not a lot I can do about it. I can't turn around to work and say, no, I'm refusing to go to my clients who are based in Athens.
You've never really struck me as a martyr.
No, of that, especially when it's sunny. But yeah, I can't really turn around and say, no, I refuse to do all that because of the carbon footprint that will leave. So again, it boils down to, whilst there is absolutely a number of things that can be done that individuals can take to improve their carbon footprint, the vast bulk of the solutions here is going to boil down to investment in technology, so that you can remove reduce the carbon emissions from things, from transport and planes and trains and automobiles.
Living in the rich industrialised country as we do, even if you were to turn around to your work and say, I'm not going to fly to Greece, I'm afraid I just can't. My carbon footprint will go through the roof and the WWF will condemn me.
Which one's that? The wrestlers or the...
probably both.
The Rock will come round and throw you through a table.
That could be one way the environmental movement just needs better communication, obviously. But you'll still benefit from the advantages of being in the rich industrial West, even if you do that. In the same way, we've got one or two acquaintances who... they're passionate about helping the environment. They'll get things like eco phones, even though they're obviously terrible and don't really work. Even if you try and opt out and go off grid, the fact that you're living in a rich industrialised country, you still benefit from. And the fact that you're not living in Bangladesh and your home isn't at risk from flooding as a cause of climate change, you're still benefiting from that as well. So I think it is trying to change that culture of the fact that we do just consume a lot of stuff and we don't really care about the consequences. And even if we were to find a way of turning carbon into bricks or whatever it is they're doing now, that extractive culture of burning the resources of the planet is still there and is being unchallenged at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the rare issues where I will say consumer culture does not help or is actually a bad thing. Generally speaking, I quite like consumer culture. It gives me lots of nice things. But just as an example of this in terms of minerals and resources as well as like the carbon miles, I'm a guitarist. I own a couple of guitars. My electric guitar was made in Mexico and shipped to Britain. My acoustic guitar was made in Japan and shipped to Britain. They're very nice instruments, but they were the carbon that's attached to something like that is going to be very high when you actually get down to it. Now, granted, I don't buy one of those every year or every week or anything like that, but it's still, there is a mass trade in these instruments, and they're being shipped all over the world.
I wouldn't want to ever suggest you shouldn't be able to buy, you know, a Fender Stratocaster that make, in the UK because of carbon, because that would carbon emissions, that would be daft.
Yeah, I can't really see shutting down of global trade being a useful goal for the environmental movement.
Well, let's just check the Green Party's policies, because it wouldn't shock me.
With all the greatest respect, it's not even guitars being the most important thing that are being traded globally that might get affected by this kind of thing as well.
Yeah. So there's just so many different things which we utilise every day and we take advantage of every day, which add to this. Mm. And it's very difficult to actually kind of get yourself out of that tangled web.
I mean, maybe where we should almost finish this one where we finished off our previous conversation and maybe talk about the possibility of a carbon tax. Because Justin Trudeau, everyone's favourite progressive, he's now talking about carbon pricing, which means that tier four grandmothers are coming to him on television and saying they can't afford anything.